I've spent most of our time saying, oh man, the 20s are so hard. And I know that because I've been working in this space behind closed doors for 25 years. But the expectation that we get from culture that idealizes youth or from social media where, you know, it's supposed to be this super glamorous time where, you know, going to all these amazing parties and you look fantastic, is that people hear that their 20s are going to be the best years of their lives. Empirically, for all the reasons I've been talking about the whole time we've been chatting, this is not the case. And that's really good news. It's probably not also the time of life when you're going to have everything sorted and figured out and like check the box, declare completion. That's really not what's going to happen in your 20s. And honestly, I'm confused about why people keep thinking this still. I thought the memo was out that, yeah, you got to start working on it. I mean, I'm the defining decade lady, but you're not going to be done at 30. Everything's not going to be done. You just better be working on it.
But first, these messages.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today I'm joined by Meg J. Welcome.
Hey, Mark. Great to be here.
Well, I'm so excited you're here because I know I could have used you when I was in my 20s. I mean, probably beyond my 20s, let's be honest. But, you know, I feel like your work really speaks to just the level of transformation that's asked of us in our 20s. And all the, we think we have time, you know, I think that's often the challenge when we're in our 20s. And I also thought I knew everything, which I got a cosmic 2x4 to the head on that one. So yeah, I know you're the author of The 20-Something Treatment, A Revolutionary Remedy for an Uncertain Age. And you also have the one that I know it like really resonated so deeply with people. And I love that there's an extension of this, The Defining Decade, Why Your 20s Matter and How to Make the Most of Them Now. And also Super Normal, The Secret World of the Family Hero. So I know you had a TED talk that went viral on the subject of 20 somethings. And I had seen that TED talk before, you know, ever being connected around your new book. And I was really struck by that being a message all of us need to understand. I'm curious why you believe the 20s are the hardest time of our life.
Yeah, actually, it's funny. I think some people probably experience my TED talk as being that cosmic 2x4 to the head, right, in their 20s. Is that it? That this is, you know, my previous book, The Defining Decade, was really about why your 20s are so important and transformative. As you said, so much of development is happening. People ask, like, why do you specialize in 20-somethings? Because that's where all the action is. That's when everybody's figuring everything out. And that means there's more uncertainty than at any other time in life, which brings me to the second book, which is The 20-Something Treatment, which is really about why the 20s are so difficult and why they can be a real challenge from a mental health perspective, but also why they are the time when our mental health starts to shift, you know, kind of turn around and start to trend upward. So it's a transformative time for mental health then. It's, you know, it can be a mental health low point, but it's also a mental health turning point when people start to feel better rather than worse.
Do you think the aspect of the challenge that the 20s is because you're in this chasm between like the and what determines the mental health impact that has us on this downward trend? So because we're between these worlds, like we're not, it means the low is there, right? The bottom.
Right. Yeah. So there's like a J-shaped curve that describes sort of well-being and mental health across the lifespan. So from childhood, you know, dips down through adolescence, bottoms out in your 20s, right, but the good news starts to turn upwards. And then the super good news is that it's better across 30s, 40s, 50s. So, I mean, the really good news is that life gets better as you go. You know, your 20s are probably not going to be the best years of your life, but that's actually a good thing. I mean, something has really gone wrong if the 20s are the best years of your life and the rest of it is just misery. So it's not going to be like that. But, you know, one of the reasons the 20s are so hard is because of, you know, in modern adulthood, you know, we're between sort of the stability and, you know, kind of the kid milestones and then the adult milestones of, you know, partner, being a parent, having a home, like having career clarity, understanding identity. that those things happen later than they used to. So we have this 10-year period of uncertainty. The brain doesn't like uncertainty. And I think people idealize, oh, how great it is not to have a mortgage or a house or like a partner or a kid. And it's actually kind of hard not to have any of those things and just to feel mm-hmm. like you're working toward them. You think maybe you want them. You're not sure how they're going to work out. That's a lot of uncertainty to wake up to every day. In our 20s, it's really the only sort of long span that you wake up every morning going, I really don't know anything about what my life's going to be like in 5 years.
That'd be great if we could actually be with that reality, you know, the level of uncertainty that's actually present. And I wonder right? if there's sort of a denial of recognizing that we maybe don't have our poop in a group, you know, that we we don't have it figured out. And we want to present as having that because, you know, when I think about things like wanting to have kids or wanting to get married, I mean, all these things that we think like, what a beautiful thing. But when we look at research, like all those things are correlated to psychological safety and the experience of some certainty. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. And that's what I think it's hard. You know, people, I think as a culture, we idealize being free of all those things. And I'm not suggesting 20-somethings rush into those things if they don't not ready for them or don't have them yet. I'm just saying it's very hard to have a good 5, 10, 15-year stretch where you don't have much external safety and you actually don't have a lot of internal certainty either because you're not feeling confident about work or about relationships or about yourself. So there's, you know, not a lot you feel like you can really hang your hat on inside or out. And it's really, really hard. And I think we forget that. I know during the pandemic, there were a lot of articles about what is wrong with 20-somethings? Why are they struggling with the pandemic so much? When my heart really went out to them, because during the pandemic, I was waking up every day in a house full of the people I had created, you know, with my family who I loved. We were all together. My career was, you know, going to be okay because, you know, it could adapt to the pandemic, et cetera. But then you had 20-somethings who were waking up alone or in apartments with roommates they weren't, you know, necessarily vibing with and not knowing about their careers, not knowing how they would pay their bills. It's very difficult to be in your 20s. And I think that's something that culturally we either trivialize or we pathologize. We say, well, they're struggling. Well, they must have some sort of disorder or they're anxious or depressed when, you know, maybe they're just struggling.
Yeah. I wonder if we can, like, I don't know, when I think about looking back at my 20s, you know, am I doing an accurate audit of the actual severity of the difficulty? You know what I mean? Like, I also, in my 20s, at late 20s is really when social media started, you know, and I consider the impact that has on people now who are in their mid late 20s. They've grown up most of the most challenging social years and milestone years, you know, it where we want to reach these perceived important milestones. But now we have so much more comparison that's just like, right. And a lot of it false, like oh, look at the person who's always, you know, happy and is an influencer. And it's
skydiving
like,
and in a bathing suit.
Right.
And, you know, being amazing.
Right. Right. Yeah, being amazing.
Yeah. It's, and that, you know, I think the tricky thing is that, you know, fortunately that's known. People understand that now. I think when I wrote The Defining Decade, people were really just first talking about that of like, hey, maybe this is sort of a mixed bag. I think the fact that it's a mixed bag is 100% known at this point.
Yeah.
However, your brain is still going to do what your brain is going to do, that it's going to, you know, compare. I mean, that's because the brain is trying to understand where, how do I stand? You know, where do I stand compared to my peers? How do I stack up? So when it gets information, it's going to try to figure that out, even though there's no answer, no real way to quantify it. But so we're sort of bombarding our brains with data that it's going to try to respond to. And it's a lot of work to, you know, 10, 1,000 times a day go, hold on, this is, you know, it's, what you see is not necessarily what you get. And, you know, I can't compare myself to other people and their success has no impact on my success and all the stuff. But that's a lot for your brain to have to do tens or hundreds or thousands of times a day.
man, especially given social media, because that's amplified by so many more, especially because so many people, regardless of their age, are addicted to these platforms that just continue to feed this. You know, you've been working with 20 somethings for 25 years. Plus.
It's crazy. 25 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm curious, why do you seem to have like such a healthy obsession in specializing in that group?
Well, I mean, like I said, to me, that's just where all the action is. I just love it. You know, if 80% of life's most defining moments take place by age 35. So your 20s are when.
Wow.
Yes, I know. And it's totally true when you think about your
80%,
life.
That's a front-loaded life. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, and yes, the adult milestones are happening a bit later than they used to, clustering more around 30 than 20. But what that means is that someone who specializes in 20-somethings, I get to help people get in front of those defining moments, get in front of those milestones, try to help them do them right and get through this really uncertain time. So, you know, it's a period of incredible change and transformation, tons of opportunity from my side of the room. And at the same time, I know that on the other side of the room, it can be a difficult time from a mental health perspective because the brain doesn't like all that uncertainty and not knowing yet, you know, which way to go or how life's going to work or, you know, not feeling confident about being able to work that out.
Do you think with like when you look at societal's expectations and perception of 20s, you know, how do you think it impacts decision making processes and where our life trajectory is going and what can we do to navigate if we are a 20 something or we're in relationship with 20 somethings, which is probably everybody listening? Mm-hmm. How do we help support that or support ourselves?
You know, I mean, my approach in the 20-something treatment, I mean, it's really, you know, it's precision medicine for mental health based on, you know, age. It's age specific of what's unique about the 20-somethings. What are unique struggles? What are unique solutions? And I think if you can really ground yourself in the context of, you know, what are some important things to understand about the realities of 20-something life, which I can rattle off in just a minute. But if you ground yourself in those, you're less likely to do what I mentioned earlier, which is trivialize of like, what's the big deal? Just get it together or you'll be fine. Or, you know, you're such a snowflake or if you're having trouble, you're fragile. And the other end of the spectrum of, oh, my gosh, you're struggling. You have a disorder. We better get you on some medication instead of tolerating. I definitely have some parents who panic when their kids are struggling. And I say, of course they're struggling. They're in a new town. They don't have a job yet, struggling to make friends. Of course they're crying. And like, let's figure out. I mean, that's their body and their brain saying, I need people. I need purpose. I need, you know, structure. So let's help them get those things. And that's what's going to help somebody feel better, not being diagnosed with something or being told that they're disordered because they're feeling that way.
Yeah, we definitely see that so much in today's world. And again, you know, coming back to social media, there's so much self-diagnosis of things rather than, yeah. And I think rather than really being in the, let's say, the storm of it. And I get as parents, I'm just a new parent. My son's only one, so I haven't had to.
Oh, congrats.
Thanks. I could prepare through talking to you now in preparation.
You've got a huge lead on it. Yes.
Yeah, I'm ahead of the curve here. I'm processing my own so he doesn't have to. But when I think about just the continued sort of, I guess, mental health challenges, quote unquote, that are pathologized rather than being evidence of what is a normal response to an uncertain time. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I do. That's my whole job. And to say, what are they telling me about what you need? The skills you don't have, the experiences you don't have, you know, the life situations you don't have, that's what I want to know is what's going on, not let me look up at this up in the DSM, what can I call it? I mean, there's, you know, many 20-somethings, you can find something in the DSM and go, okay, sure, they meet those criteria, but what good is that necessarily doing someone if, you know, to feel like, oh, great, you know, I'm disordered, I'm broken, versus this is a normal response to not having a job or to not having friends or to not finding love or to having your heart broken. So let's figure out what are the skills or experiences that you need to feel better?
I know you speak, you use the word snowflake.
Well, I have a buddy who uses it. But,
no, I know. I know you don't, because it's a demeaning.
I get upset about people who use it. Yes.
Yeah, it's a demeaning, sort of shaming. Not sort of, it's a shaming term. And I hear it a lot. I definitely do hear it a lot. I hear it a lot in when we're having conversations about the circumstances of, let's say, quote unquote, young people's work ethic. You know, I know someone who's a university professor who told me in like 2012, 2013, he's like, my students are such snowflakes. I remember him saying that. And I want to be able to understand, because I think we talk about younger generations. I sound like a old guy now where I'm like, when I was young, it wasn't, you know, but that they're so sensitive. They don't want to work. Can you speak to this and maybe how we develop more context or compassion in that space?
I mean, I love that compassion, I think, does come from context. And I have been working with 20-somethings for 25 years, including on college campuses, not just in my office. And they're not snowflakes. That's not what's going on. Or, you know, there's an article somewhere almost every day about young workers, you don't know how to email. What is wrong with them? Well, that isn't a skill that they've needed up until now. So, I mean, you know, if we complain about what young workers don't know how to do, well, we could talk about what they're not learning in college that maybe they ought to be. But, you know, there's an enormous growth curve, like it's very steep learning curve that happens when people have their first jobs. And, you know, they don't know a lot of things that you and I take for granted as professionals now, such as how to send a professional email or how to give a presentation or, you know, a hard start of 9 means a hard start of 9. That, you know, it may sound like they're just choosing not to know these things, but that's just not the reality that they probably had when they were in college or if they were at some less serious job. So, I mean, I think honestly, it's usually just a lack of experience and information. And that most 20-somethings, when you say, hey, I need you to do it this way, or I don't know if you know this, but if you're going to email somebody, you should X, Y, or Z. They're like, oh, I didn't know that.
I wonder, you know, because I guess I wonder on some level, it's like, can there be generational differences that are true, you know, in that, let's say Gen X or Gen Y is different than Gen, I'm trying to remember all the different delineations.
What are they? Yeah.
But I wonder, is there generational differences that cause this perception that there actually is a difference in desired life outcomes and the work we want to do and what we're going to tolerate? Like there's that actually breed this judgment of a snowflake or a lack of work ethic?
I mean, yes and no. I do think a lot of developmental differences are confused with generational differences, that they'll say today's young adults are the least happy in history. Look at them compared to 30-somethings and 40-somethings and 50-somethings, when for 30 years, young adults have been the least happy adults. This is for reasons that we just described, that it's like, well, I have the worst job I'll ever have and the least money I'll ever have. And I'm the loneliest I'll ever be. And I'm the least confident. Of course I'm unhappy. So, I mean, that's sort of the way it's going to be. And that's not a generational problem. It's a developmental problem, which is kind of where I come in. You know, I think every generation of young worker pushes back on structure, you know, on because that's their job. I mean, they're you know, sort of older adolescents. Their job is to question things and to say, we're going to do it differently. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm a Gen Xer. I was a 20-something in the 90s. I mean, we had office space. So people have been pushing back on, you know, office culture for quite some time, you know, or if you go way back before my time to The Graduate, you know, remember the whole, you know, plastics, people are going to, anyway, you got to see it. And young people out there who haven't seen The Graduate. So, I mean, that is the job of young workers, is to come into something and say, why do we do it this way? And sometimes it will become clear that we're doing this way because there's actually a good reason for that. And other times, young workers are onto something and they have ideas and new ways of doing things that end up, you know, changing the way things are done. During the pandemic, it was sort of the perfect intersection of, hey, why do we do it this way? Plus, the planet shut down and everybody had to figure out how to work differently. I mean, I think the remote work revolution, you know, was certainly aided by a younger generation that was like, well, I don't have to show up in person for everything. I mean, wouldn't it be a lot easier if we could just Zoom once in a while? But it also would never have happened if there hadn't been a pandemic and everybody said, oh, shoot, we actually cannot come into work. So, you know, there's always more than one thing going on, I think.
What are some, I know you've listed some of the challenges, but I am curious, what are some of the sort of very obvious, explicit challenges that or obstacles that we do have in our 20s?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think they're obvious. I don't think enough people know these. So I'll just give you some data points. There's a lot more in the book. I'm sure I'll forget. So I'll just rattle through some factoids that help people go, oh, shoot. Yeah. Context and compassion. So your average 20-something is going to have 9 different jobs by the age of 35. So that's a lot of...
That's crazy.
Yes. I think at some point in my 20s, I might have had 9 jobs at once. But that's a lot of occupational uncertainty. And, you know, it's not fun to, you know, to be several jobs away from sort of where you feel like you're going to land. Most are going to end up in careers or positions that they'd never heard of when they were in college or just out of college, or that maybe didn't even exist then. So that question of, well, what are you going to do and who are you going to be? They literally cannot answer that question because they're going to end up doing things that they haven't even heard of yet. In terms of friendships, we know that the 20s are the loneliest time of life, which is contrary to everything you would think from social media, where 20-somethings are like constantly having fun with their friends. No, not true. It's the only time of life really when we're like solidly between our two families, which we were talking about earlier. So, you know, you wake up alone most of the time, which is lonely. And friends are really coming and going. I have a lot of clients who are lovely people, perfectly capable of making friends, but their friends just moved away or they've just moved to a new city or their best friend, you know, got a boyfriend and can't hang out anymore. And so it can be a very lonely time. About 50% of 20-somethings say they don't really have any close friends. And part of that is all the mobility. What else do we know? About 50% feel anxious. About 40% feel depressed. About 30% feel suicidal. And about 20% struggle with substances. And most young adults, even though they crave purpose and meaning, they won't actually find it in their 20s. That most say they have that sense of purpose and meaning in their 30s and beyond, which makes a ton of sense because around the globe, most people have purpose and meaning. They say it comes from work or love. And to my previous points, that 20-somethings are still sorting out work and love. So purpose feels like a long way off. So it's tough. I don't know about you, but I don't know anyone who would go back to their 20s, not because it's so bad, but because of what comes after actually is better.
Yeah, I like that perspective because it's true. I would take myself at 32 way before I'd take myself at 25.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like so many of the challenges of my 20s really woke me up to who I was, how I was behaving, what my values are, what my mission was, what my purpose was. Like, as you're saying, you know, you find, what is that saying, that you turn your mess into your message. And I think that's very much what the 20s serves. And there's also this individuation, as you're saying, that happens from our parents. And yet, you know, I love how you said in, I think it was in your TED Talk, that you talked about how, like, we can't always choose our family, but we actually can. Like at some point, not
you
only do
are,
we choose
yeah.
to create, yeah, you would create yeah. one ourselves, but we also choose the people we hang out with. And
right.
and even the statement we can't choose our family infers that there's some sort of prison sentence to the people we are kin with, as opposed right. to being like, oh, we actually, part of growing up and being an adult is choosing who we surround ourselves with.
Right. Or how those relationships go, that you actually have choices in that still. And yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of a big shift for 20-somethings, is going from sort of what has happened to me, you know, that my parents happened to me or the pandemic happened to me or whatever, to like, okay, well, what am I going to do about it? Because, you know, right. I can't necessarily change what happened to me. But, you know, you're right on when you say, what was it, turn your mess into your message, of that the way people find out what is right for them at work, what is right for them in a partner, what is their purpose, is they usually bump up against some things that aren't right, you know, jobs mm-hmm. and relationships that don't feel so great. So it's you know, may feel like a painful and inefficient way to learn, but I can't really imagine how else you would go about doing that. And, you know, that's part of the 20s too, which is another thing that makes it hard, is the number one precursor to depression in young adults is a significant loss, usually of a relationship. So breakups often lead people to feel depressed, but really what we're looking at is loss and grieving. And that's actually healthy. That tells us, like, oh, your attachment system is working. You know, you had this thing mm-hmm. and you thought it was going to be great and you love this person. They're gone now. You're feeling devastated. That's actually how your brain is supposed to respond. It doesn't mean you're going to feel this way forever.
As spring unfolds in the Northern Hemisphere, I am swapping out and putting away all my winter essentials so I can gear up for some spring and summer temps. And a key part of this transition is replacing my cozy winter duvet with something lighter. And the Cloud Knit blanket from Cozy Earth is my top pick. This blanket strikes the perfect balance. It keeps me warm during the lingering spring chill, yet it's light enough for the rising temperatures. What sets Cozy Earth apart is their commitment to quality and comfort. Every item they create is exceptionally soft and designed for temperature regulation. Plus, the machine washable feature ensures convenience without compromising texture. In other words, no snags on the textiles like the knit of the Cloud Blanket. Crafted from premium materials, Cozy Earth's products are ethically made, reflecting their dedication to responsible production. What truly resonates with me is how Cozy Earth goes beyond creating fantastic products. They embody values like living well and serving others, and weave these principles into each item they produce. Speaking of their serving heart, Cozy Earth has generously offered for our listeners a massive 40% off discount on all their products. Just head over to CozyEarth.com and use the code Groves at checkout. Again, that's CozyEarth.com and use the code Groves for 40% off.
What do you think about some of the ways that we respond perceptionally to, you know, grief of, let's say, the loss of a partnership or the anxiety and depression that you're speaking to, that would be a natural response to not just uncertainty, but also being inundated with, I think, like, cultural things are also impacting that, like cancel culture and, you know, the lack of ability to have diverse dialogue, feeling free to be self-expressed. Like, there's a lot riding on the self-expression of a 20 something, especially because I think in that decade, we really prioritize belonging over self-expression. Like, we're almost in some sort of battle recognizing that if I keep selling myself out, compromising myself, all these types of things, in order to maintain group membership, which I totally understand, we start to realize that, like, I think the inflammation that's created by that starts to catch up to us. Like, we start to actually experience physiological responses, which, I, you know, is anxiety and depression, I think, in a large part. Right. So how do you see medicine and doctor's offices and things like that responding? Because I love how you're saying, like, we're so quick to medicate as opposed to contextualize, which would then, because I really think it's through that suffering that if we can be guided and loved in that process and validated, that we can actually transform. And I'd really love your message about that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, we are quick to pathologize and medicate, and it's not just, so, you know, what can be helpful is to instead normalize and educate and say, this is a normal response to a depression. This is a normal fear to worry about being left out from your peers. I mean, your brain wants to belong. It needs to belong. And so I think normalizing that, contextualizing that, and then also helping people figure out, okay, what are the skills that I'm lacking? So the book is a lot about sort of skills over pills. But I'm not saying, you know, no medication ever.
Right.
As much as, well, I don't, whether you're on that medication or not, you also need skills. And everybody needs skills. And most young adults don't want to be on medication forever if they're even on it. So what's happening in this relationship where you're feeling, you know, chronically stressed and anxious? What are the skills that you're lacking there in terms of communicating to someone what you need? So I have a client who's in a relationship, and of course, there's the giant piece of uncertainty. You know, is this person the one? And, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that, you know, he often feels sort of stressed and anxious when something happens between them that he doesn't like. And then he's going to be kind of stuck with that for the rest of his life. And I said, well, I don't really see why that would be, because you could talk to the person about it. And it's not like you're choosing to put up with this thing that you don't like forever or not. It's, can we work on the skills where you communicate with your partner? You know, actually, I kind of need this, or I'm not sure that feels good to me. And that then you can feel less stressed and less anxious about what your partner's doing, because you realize this is kind of a two-way street here.
What do you think is revolutionary about the approach that you're taking to 20-something mental health?
Yeah, what's revolutionary about it is that it's precision, age-specific approach. So when I'm working with a 20-something, and the first thing I'm asking myself, well, I'm contextualizing it, is this what I would expect from a 20-something in mm-hmm. their position? And what are sort of the normal developmental stressors? What are the skills that that person needs? I mean, if I have a 20-something who's crying every day after work, that's very different than a 45-year-old who's crying every day after work. They're going to be for completely different reasons. Your 20-something mm-hmm. who's crying every day after work is probably stressed and trying to figure out, you know, how do I get my skills up? They're on a steep learning curve. That's very stressful. A 45-year-old who's crying every day after work is probably having a crisis of meaning, or some, you know, really deeply unhealthy relationship with a boss or a coworker. So, and they have a lot sort of other things to work with. So, you know, what's revolutionary about it is it's saying we need to put this in the context of 20-something development, so that we're not pathologizing what's going on, and not trivializing it.
What would be the top skills that we would need? Like, I love skills over pills. I'm like, that's freaking great. What is the prescription?
Good, yeah. What are the skills? So there's 12 chapters. They're literally how to's. So I probably won't get all 12, but I'll throw out half a dozen that are in there. The first two are pretty key because they go with us in all contexts. So it's how to think and how to feel. And we can talk about these more if you like in a minute. I've got how to have sex, because I've got more than one client who's like, wow, I'm watching too much porn and not getting out there right. and having actual yeah. relationships with people. How to love is in there, which is really about how to love and get your heart broken, which we talked about earlier, that, you know, it hurts, but that's actually the way it's supposed to happen. Believe it or not, how to cook is in there. I don't share recipes, but I do talk about the real benefits for young adults to learn how to cook, that it's, you know, one opportunity in their day to have a recipe and instructions and to be able to do it and see the results of something, you know, right at a time when they can't see the results of all their other hard work for many years. And then how to choose purpose, because like we talked about a minute ago, young adults want purpose. They can feel stressed that they don't have it. But I talk about how it tends to be one of the later skills to develop, but that's normal. And we talk some about, you know, how to start choosing to have purpose in your life, no matter how you are.
Yeah, for how to think and how to feel, I am curious. I like it, this prescription of like, here's how you think, here's how you feel. What does it look or sound like?
Yeah, so the how to think, I mean, you could write a whole book on how to think, but, you know, in the chapter I picked out sort of the most common issue with thinking in young adults is catastrophic thinking. So when we're confronted with uncertainty, it's normal for the brain to imagine the worst. We have a better safe than sorry brain. Our brain is wired to keep us alive, not happy. So it's going to imagine that the bear is around the corner rather than the little bunny rabbit. That's totally normal. But 20-somethings think more catastrophically and more negatively than older adults because they have less experience learning that, you know, it's actually probably not a bear around the corner. And if it is, I actually know how to do some jujitsu on bears. So they don't have that when they're in their 20s. So there's a lot of what-ifing that goes on. And what I do with clients and what I talk about in the chapter is how to shift from the what-if thinking to the what-is thinking, how to get your brain to shift from fears to facts of like, well, what do we really know about this situation and what's happened here before and how did you deal with it previously and what would happen if it did happen, and just to be more fact-based than fear-based. And then there's also shifting to what else, because sometimes 20-somethings will say, well, I don't have any facts. I don't know anything about what would happen. So you can say, well, let's talk about what else it might be besides a bear. You know, could it be your boss is reaching out to you for some reason other than to fire you, and just to spend more time with the what is and the what else. And that may seem like, well, how does that help? But, you know, how it helps is there's only so much time in the day for our brain to have thoughts. And if we just let it have what is thoughts all the time, we're going to feel extremely stressed and anxious. But when we teach our brain, there's another way to think about this, there's another way to imagine this, then we get better at that skill. And now, I don't know, but I'm guessing for you, and it's certainly true for where I am in life, when scary stuff or uncertain things happen, my initial impulse is, oh my gosh, and you think the worst. But then pretty quickly, I'm able to say, okay, well, that's probably not it. Or if it is, I can handle it. And what else can I think? And what can I do to address this? But when you're in your 20s, you feel really stuck with that what if.
Prepare yourself, because I might make you hungry as you listen to my most recent experience with Factor's roasted garlic butter salmon and celery root cauliflower mash with Parmesan broccoli. Need I say more? This keto-friendly, calorie-smart, and protein-plus dish was beyond. Definitely didn't taste like how I would have imagined a pre-made meal to taste. It felt both freshly home-cooked and elevated. The mash was as velvety as they said. The salmon with the roasted garlic butter sauce was out of this world. I'm still dreaming about how delicious it was. Now, what I loved most was how it was not only great tasting, but it was also satiating. I felt like I ate a good and not overly filling meal. Now, if I was still hungry, I also learned you can add on things like juices, shakes, and snacks. I've got my eye on the keto cheesecake for my next order. Now, no matter your eating or dietary style, Factor creates meals with their flexible menu of chef-crafted, dietitian-approved options. They use pasture-raised, grass-fed ingredients that are free of gluten, antibiotics, hormones, refined sugars, soy, preservatives, and GMOs. Factor is less expensive than takeout and is 100% ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. Want some roasted garlic butter salmon for yourself? Seriously, it was so good. Head to factormeals.com/markgross50 and use the code markgross50 to get 50% off. That's code markgross50 at factormeals.com/markgross to get 50% off.
How do you think the inundation of information and access to sort of catastrophic news and catastrophic, because I think about that a lot.
Yeah.
That I wasn't exposed to that when I was 14, 15, 16. The first time that I was sold comfort and convenience and actually derailed from being present in my life was a BlackBerry. You know, and right. That was the beginning. That was sort of like the creep to taking every second of someone's life. And, you know, I look at, if I was in my 20s today and didn't have some level of nervous system regulation and the ability to discern, which is only learned, like I'm only learning that. I have over a million followers on Instagram, and I've had to learn that I'm not meant to be in connection with that many thoughts, feelings, opinions, projections.
Yeah, I mean, I have never met a 20-something who said, you know what, really wish I spent more time on my phone. Right. Never. No one has ever in, you know, now it's been half of the 25 years I've been doing this that social media has been a thing. No one has ever said, I wish I did that more. I think it's really on us to figure out what's a healthy relationship with my devices or with the sites that I'm on, and how do I manage that? How do I think about that? I'm not saying it's easy, but ultimately no one is going to do it for us to say, I don't think this kind of news is good for you. And this particular site is really, every time you go there, you end up feeling badly. So I do think that we have to do a gut check of how am I spending my precious time in my 20s, and how is it making me feel, especially on devices?
Yeah, I feel myself really blessed that things like OnlyFans and Instagram and stuff like that didn't exist in my early 20s, late teens, because I think just due to my life being very much directed by my smaller brain, you know, that it was...
Sure.
I don't know that I would have had the discernment, you know, And that's why I just look and I'm like, man, are we, I don't think we have the skills because it's never been required before. And I think a lot of parents don't model it for their kids. So the behavior is not learned through the discernment of the parent and their relationship with technology. So, you know, we like let kids have phones far too young, in my opinion, and social media too young. And I'm not negating the sort of social pressure to do those things. But I look and I'm like, I know so many people who are anxious due to the fact that they overconsume technology. And
sure,
how could they not? I think a large part of that is if you don't have access to discernment and your voice, then you can't direct your life. And and if you can't direct your life because you can't use your voice, then you're going to feel anxious because you're not in any sort of control of the outcomes or the direction. And you know, that's why I think a lot of that anxiety is really an invitation. But like, what social media, no social media platform is motivated to get you more discernment and less on your phone. They're not.
Right.
Are they going to fund the research that they suck? No way.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. This is never going to come from anyone but you. And And I'm not saying it's easy, but also 20-somethings are not idiots. They 100% understand this. And I'm not saying that therefore now there's the solution, but they know it. They all say, I mean, it's interesting if you ask people, which I do every intake, I ask people about their relationship with their phone, social media, porn, you know, all device use. And, you know, many can say, you know, I'm probably on it too much, but it's not really a big problem for me. And it's, that seems correct. And then many others say, oh gosh, you know, and often I'll say, well, pull out your phone. Let me see your screen time. Like, show me, like, tell me what it was. And they'll say, oh, this is so embarrassing. It was 10 hours yesterday. Say, okay, well, there's some low hanging fruit to start with.
That's like, a job.
So what if we don't do that and then just get you out even a little bit more? And most 20 somethings want a healthier relationship with their devices, and they are working on it in some way or another. And it's a challenge, but not even just for young adults, really for adults of all ages.
Well, what are some expectations that, you know, because I think these all tie in to, again, the amplification of the struggles, but the struggles still exist. So I'm like, what are some expectations that we might have about our 20s that we need to flip or like invert?
Yeah, well, actually, social media is really the perfect lead into that, because I've spent most of our time saying, oh, man, the 20s are so hard. And I know that because I've been working in this space behind closed doors for 25 years. But the expectation that we get from culture that idealizes youth, or from social media where, you know, it's supposed to be this super glamorous time where, you know, you're going to all these amazing parties and you look fantastic, is that people hear that their 20s are going to be the best years of their lives. You know, empirically, for all the reasons I've been talking about the whole time we've been chatting, this is not the case. And that's really good news. It's probably not also the time of life when you're going to have everything sorted and figured out and like check the box and, you know, declare completion. That's really not what's going to happen in your 20s. I'm confused about why people keep thinking this still. I thought the memo was out that, yeah, you got to start working on it. I mean, I'm the defining decade lady, but you're not going to be done at 30. Everything's not going to be done. You just better be working on it. So I think helping people understand you're not behind, you're not doing something wrong. These are not going to be the best years of your life. Thank goodness. You don't want to peak in your 20s.
You don't want to peak in your 20s.
I
love the provocative idea that like 30 is not the new 20, because it's like, yo, like do some shit with your 20s so that 30 is not the same as your 20s, right? Like actually make the vitality part of 20s great, but not the same patterns of behavior that leave us into the, you know, it's like you end up lost, but you know, I think for everyone that sort of age old adage is like, that's, actually, you can only be found through loss. You know, you can only love through grief. You can, these are all contrasts that are required to live a deep, meaningful life, not the avoidance of pain, because the irony is where your pain lives, love lives. So it's like, well, right. You better walk into it.
You know? Well, and avoidance is pretty miserable too. And so I every 20 something I know who's avoiding, they're miserable. So that's not an answer. I think that it's, you know, the brain, especially a brain that's been in school for 20 years, gets into their 20s and they're like, I want the right answer. I want to make an A. I want to know, like, what's the timeline? Is this the right city? Is this the right partner? Is this the right job? And, you know, in adulthood, there aren't right answers. There are just your answers or what's right for you. And to your point, the only way to figure that out is to bump into some things that aren't right for you and that don't feel good. And I mean, that's how you feel what is right for you. There's no other way to know it. But I think people come to my office and they think, especially given who I am, that I would just know whether right. they should, you know, like, should I be a producer or a reporter? I don't know. Do you that's feel better funny. In front of the camera or behind the camera? I really don't know. So you're going to have to get out there and be uncomfortable and figure out, is this temporary growth pains or is this really not for me? And that's how you learn. Life is the best therapist. I tell people that all the time, that I don't have the answers. The answers to 20-something struggles cannot be that everybody gets a therapist, because that's not scalable. It's not affordable. It's not accessible. And, you know, fortunately, I think most 20-somethings don't need a therapist. Maybe they just need a book like mine. I mean, that's why I wrote it. So,
right. Well, the accessibility to that. And I think when we start to, you know, in our 20s, really step into, as you've been mentioning, like that, we become a self, we become an individual. I mean, I think that's important to do through the context of the experience we have with our parents, but I don't think a lot of parents are selves yet, you know? And so they don't sort of impart or reinforce that in their child, that they have their own feelings, their own direction, their own dreams. And when I think about the question of going to you and saying, should I be a reporter or should I be a producer? Again, there's this idea that someone outside of me will direct what I'm doing. And I think, like, I wish I learned in my 20s, although never too late, but I wish I had the reflection that you're saying to recognize I was even doing that sort of subcontracting authority. Here I keep going. Someone else knows, the therapist, the boss, the parent, and I was like, man, that's Francis Weller has this great saying where he says, we spend our lives looking for a place of belonging, but at some point we have to become the place of welcome. And I think that 20s is where that orientation can shift. And yes. Like, you offer a sense of hope. Like, that's, I don't think people in their 20s, they're so shit on that they don't have hope. They're like, here, I don't want to work. I'm lonely. I'm too needy. I'm a snowflake. And it's right. like, ah, that's hard. That's a lot
yeah,
of shame.
Oh, wow. That's, yeah, absolutely. And I when kind of quiet quitting was a thing a few years ago, seems like a million years ago now, but it was probably 5 minutes ago. But anyway, when quiet quitting was a thing, people were asking me about it. I was like, you know, I want to help 20-somethings find jobs. They don't want to quiet quit. I mean, that's
right.
That's what we want. I mean, I love my job. And I mean, I didn't love it when I was in my 20s. I was not where
Neither
I am
I.
Now. So, but I want to help people find jobs that they don't want to quiet quit or that they don't want to quit. But I mean, hope is really important. And that is part of the message of, hey, these might not be the best years of your life, but that's actually really good, that good things are coming. The best is yet to come. And we actually know that for people getting better in therapy, even just the therapist having the expectation and the hope that, yeah, I think you're going to get better, makes a big difference in terms of whether people actually improve in therapy. And that's something I'm trying to impart through the book of, I don't know you, but based on everything that I know from 25 years of 20-something development, I expect that your mental health is going to get better as you get better at life, as you get better in your, you know, going through your 20s and beyond. I mean, I absolutely have that expectation. And hope is important, not just because it helps people get up in the morning, but people who have hope are more likely to sort of work toward those goals, you know, engage in healthy behaviors, because they start to think like, oh, this could really matter. Maybe I should do something. This could work out. And so I think we have to be sure we're giving young adults hope instead of saying, ah, too bad you were born when you were born. It's never been right, so bad. Because right. I don't really think that's the case.
I agree with you. I think the complexities of the world are, we can access complexity of the world across the world that we normally were only exposed to sort of what's in our regional space. And now we're taking on the problems of the whole planet, which
right.
is just overwhelming. And then someone in their 20s is like, I got to change all of this or else my future is effed, which that's way too much. It's like, you should be enjoying it, going on adventures and like put down your phone, you know, unless you're listening to this podcast.
But they could be walking and listening to it on there, you know, walking, having a beautiful walk.
What are some practical strategies or exercises from your book that young adults, and I would imagine this would relate to anyone who sort of feels lost, but what are some practical things that young adults can implement to make the most out of their 20s and set themselves up for success in the future? And for those listening who are like, I might need to reclaim my 20s and my 40s. Great. Right, let's go.
Right.
Yeah. Never too late.
Never too late. We always just start where we are. But I mean, really in the 20 something treatment, I'm focusing on age specific solutions, but they're also the same things that make people happier and healthier in their 30s and beyond. And just teaching them to people who are like, well, this is new to me. I didn't know this. So it's learning how to think less catastrophically and more flexibly in terms of feelings. It's understanding that feelings pass, that no feeling lasts forever, including the great ones. So, you know, that honeymoon period in a relationship, sorry, doesn't last forever. But neither do your lowest lows. And how do we kind of wait for those feelings to pass and work with what those feelings are telling us? You know, obviously having a friend is important. I think when you're in your 20s, you know, figuring out how to be intimate with another person is important. Moving, cooking, deciding, you know, learning how to make decisions that don't have right answers and not sort of doing that thing where you say like, oh, if only I had done this thing I didn't do, everything would have been perfect, because that's just a fiction you're telling yourself. So, you know, in the book, it really talks about the skills that we need, that you and I are probably still working on, but are probably a little bit further along than we were in our 20s, of just what it means to be an adult and a human and to, you know, get through the world and through life the best we can.
Wow. I mean, that's such again, like the opportunity for hope, like you're going to get out of this, you're going to change this, you're going to find your way, and then you're going to lose your way. But it's the skill set of redirection, of curiosity, of hope, of possibility. And I mean, I really love the message from Gabor Mate and Daniel Mate's book of The Myth of Normal, that like it's a normal response to a dysfunctional world to have things like depression or anxiety. Like it's a normal response to feel that way when you're uncertain.
Right.
And I love normalizing it.
Yeah. And I mean, if you think about it, a lot of anxiety is like, I mean, this is important to me. I don't want to screw this up. So it's like, well, great. So you care about this. This matters. Let's help you figure out how to feel, you know, more confident in whatever it is, relationships or work. But, you know, your anxiety is saying, this matters to me. I want to get it right, or I want to do the best I can. And so I'm trying to help people do that.
So is it, before we close out, I'm curious, is there something that you're like, oh, we need to talk about this? There's like one thing that like we all need to know. Is there something I missed?
Well, I mean, we were talking about hope, which is really important, the power of positive expectations. So, I mean, it's worth understanding the flip side of that, as the power of negative expectations. That's called the nocebo effect. And, you know, I just want to remind listeners that that can sometimes go with, oh, I read about this thing, you know, on the internet, or I diagnosed myself with this thing on TikTok, and oh no, I'm disordered and I'm always going to be sick and I'm never going to be okay and no one's ever going to love me. That's really the power of negative expectations. And that's the opposite of hope. And so I'm trying to help people understand there's a lot of power in the positive, to watch out for the nocebo effect. There's a lot of power in the positive expectations, and that I do not expect that whatever a 20-something is struggling with today, they'll be struggling with again or still in 5 years. That is not what I expect to happen. And, you know, I hope people can find the hope in that.
That's beautiful. So for the people listening, where can they find more of you? Where can they find your books?
My new book, The 20-Something Treatment, it comes out on April 9th. It's already, you know, available for pre-order in all the places on the internet or indie bookstores. I'm at Dr. Meg J on social media. Actually, I'm the last person on Earth to join. I believe it was about 2 weeks ago. So,
way to go.
So I have a 20-something who's helping me. She's my social media alter ego. She's awesome. So you can find me there now. And go to my website if you're confused about where all you can find me. It's megj.com. And you can even message me there. I'd love to hear directly from 20-somethings or anybody.
Amazing. Well, everybody go pick up that book, gift it to a 20-something, read it if you're a 20-something, and if you identify with what we're talking about, it's applicable. And make sure you hit that subscribe button wherever you're getting this content so you don't miss future episodes. Meg J, thank you so much for coming on.
It's been a pleasure. It was really fun.